MMT says for the first time in over a year, private car sales have increased compared to the previous month, and it's now predicting the rate of overall improvement will speed up over the rest of this year.
The Foreign Office has confirmed that an 8th British embassy worker arrested in Iran has been released. One remains in custody. The Conservative leader David Cameron says his party is to carry out a review of every quango to determine which should be scrapped or slimmed down. He said too many of the unelected bodies were empire building. BBC News.
And now it's time for Woman's Hour with Jane Garvey.
And a very good morning to you. We've got the clarinetist Emma Johnson in a moment or two. Oh no, God, can you believe this? I really am very sorry. No, I'm sorry. I don't know where your gym kit is. Look, love, I am actually at work. Okay. See you later. Bye. Right, I suppose it had to happen at some point. But later in the programme this morning, what age should you give your children mobile phones? Also today, how much can you prepare parents for the challenges of caring for twins or triplets? And if you get the right advice before they're born, how much does it really help after they're born? And one of Croatia's leading novelists will talk about her new book, which explores our attitudes to ageing through the very disturbing myth of the repulsive old hag, Baba Yaga. That's all later in the programme. Now, Emma Johnson is one of the few clarinetists to have established an international career as a soloist, and she's one of this country's biggest-selling classical artists as well. You might well recall her winning the BBC's Young Musician of the Year Award in 1984. Earlier this summer, she performed the Mozart Clarinet Concerto at the Royal Albert Hall with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and she's about to play at the Cheltenham Music Festival. Sweet for Emma, played by Emma Johnson, who's here. It doesn't get much better than that. John Dankworth writing just for you. It's not bad, is it?
No, it was an incredible surprise. I'd just worked with him and his wife, Cleo Lane, on their Christmas television show. And a few weeks after that, these parcels kept arriving in the post. And each one contained a different movement of this piece called Sweet for Emma that John had written for me. So it was a great surprise, a great honour. I mean, that doesn't usually happen.
No, so. I mean, it's probably, I don't know, perhaps you're a very modest individual, it might be hard for you to talk yourself up, but why do you think your style appealed to him so much?
I don't know. He said there was something about my playing that really he could relate to, and he thought he could write music that would suit my personality, my playing, so it sort of unlocked some inspiration.
I know that you take inspiration, don't you, from vocalists. You base your performance style to a degree on the way the human voice works.
Yes, I do very much. I really think that an instrumentalist should try and mimic the human voice and have that direct expression and contact with the audience. In fact, with the clarinet, the technique is very similar. You're very aware of using your diaphragm to support the sound and of different notes resonating in different parts of your body, as happens when you're singing.
Can you sing at all?
I'm not that great at singing. It's mostly in the bath, really.
So you let yourself go in the bath.
Yes.
What about vocalists who've inspired you and perhaps influenced the way you play the clarinet? Who would you mention?
Well, you have to mention Pavarotti, who is just an incredible phenomenon of nature, and the way that his voice could do anything and had such power. There was also a great German baritone, Fischer Dieskau. I heard his final concert in London in the 1980s, and that just bowled me over. And I thought, he just had everybody hanging onto every phrase that he sang. And I just thought, that's what I want to do with the clarinet.
And what was it? Was it the power? Was it the phrasing? What was it about that particular voice?
I think it's just the direct communication that you get. It's something probably quite primeval, going back to maybe your mother singing to you when you're very young. It's something very special, that when music really envelops you and takes you over.
And can you do that with the clarinet? Because I think some people would say perhaps you can't, or at least it's tough to do that.
I would say that you can, especially in the right acoustic. Obviously, the clarinet's not quite as loud as a male voice, but given a wonderful acoustic, certainly people have told me they've been in tears after things I've played, and I assumed it was because I moved them rather than they hated it.
Come on. Of course it was because you moved them. I remember you winning the BBC's Young Musician of the Year, and you haven't changed, actually. I mean, you might think you have, but...
A bad light in here.
Oh, is it? Okay. All right. Well, perhaps actually that's... I insist on this low lighting. It's me. How was that? I mean, you were very young, and I used to watch that and just be in awe of the incredible talent displayed by some really very young people. But you'd already decided, I think, that this was going to be the life for you, hadn't you?
Well, I hadn't decided definitely, because I wanted it to be. I wanted to be a musician, but knew that it's a very hard life and you need a lucky break, otherwise you don't necessarily get all the work that you want. So I was kind of leaving it up to Young Musician of the Year to point me in whichever direction I might go in, and to, you know, just see through that whether I could possibly make it as a musician, whether I was good enough.
But you did make it. And I think your parents were encouraging, but a bit wary, weren't they?
Certainly. And I think rightly so, because, you know, it's a bit like being an actor, I suppose, or something. You can have periods out of work if you're unlucky, or if your looks aren't quite right, or something like that. But, you know, it just luckily all took off and everything snowballed.
Yeah, if your looks aren't right. I mean, did anybody ever, with all due respect to him, ever say to Acker Bilk, you could lose a few pounds, mate? I mean, it didn't work that way, did it then? And it wouldn't work with a man now, would it?
Yeah, I think it would, actually. Things have changed a lot, and everything is quite visual. Although the main thing, of course, is to play well, and yes, for your music to speak to people.
Now, lately, you've been exploring a sort of music I'd never heard of. This is music from the very rich Jewish tradition, the klezmer music.
Yes,
well,
that's
right. Now, what is that?
It's a type of folk music that grew up in the Jewish ghettos in Eastern Europe since the Middle Ages, really. And then it nearly got wiped out at the time of the persecution of the Jews by the Nazis and in Russia and so on. But some of them, it's an oral tradition, and some of them carried it to America. And it's having a revival now. It's a fascinating music because it seems to be at the roots of a lot of classical music, like Bernstein and Copland and so on. They all come from that background.
It must be completely different, though, to playing Mozart, for example.
It is rather different. There's a freedom about it that's quite exhilarating. Well, at least I hope it will be. I mean, I was persuaded by a nice lady at the Jewish Music Institute that I would play a solo spot in their Klezmer Fest in August in London. And so I haven't actually yet performed the music, but they've been giving me lessons.
Lessons, okay. Well, I'd like you to exhibit what some of the lessons have done for you so far.
This gives you a little idea of the kind of mode and scale that they use, which, you know, sounds a little bit Eastern in a way, and just the trills and the sort of sobs that they put in the sound.
Okay, let's hear that. Does that take it out of you? Because you don't keep still. Your body's moving at the same time, isn't it?
I suppose it's a dance music, and it's so yes, it is quite a bodily experience.
But actually, generally, you move when you play, don't you?
I do, yes. I never realised that I am, but people tell me afterwards. It just seems the natural thing to do to me. I think I do have quite a physical response to music, and probably that is behind why I've put in all the hours of practice and so on that you have to over the years. I have such a love of music. It takes me to such a great place that, because sometimes parents ask me, you know, should they make their child practice an instrument? And there's a brilliant book out at the moment that I think everybody should read called The Talent Code, about acquiring a skill like a musical instrument or sport. And it talks about how you're forming circuits in your brain when you do practice. So the more you fire these circuits, the more they're hardwired in your brain. But you can only do that and put in the hours if you have that motivation, which is usually a love of what you're doing, or perhaps wishing to escape from poverty, or there are many reasons, whatever.
Yeah,
but if that doesn't come from within you, if it's coming from outside, from parents or something, it usually isn't lasting enough.
So actually, you can't create a musical genius, can you? Not really.
You can, as long as you manage to get the motivation to come within them in the right way. Mm, yes.
Okay, so that's sowing the seeds. I'll try and remember that.
Okay.
Emma, it's lovely to meet you. More traditionally, away from the klezmer music, you are playing at Mozart at the Cheltenham Music Festival on the 13th of July. Details on the website, but we want to finish with some Mozart. Thank you very much, Emma. This is Clarinet Quintet in A. Emma Johnson will be performing in Cheltenham in July. Details on the Women's Hour website. Now, that nightmare scenario for any working parent, which we try to illustrate with our bit of amateur dramatics at the top of the programme. Are you just setting into the comforting rhythm of another working day when the mobile trills into life and it's Jack on his mobile from nursery? He's got a temperature and he wants you to pick him up right now so you can both go home and watch Rory the racing car all day. Well, don't rule it out, because a mobile phone, said to be so simple a four-year-old could use it, will go on sale in the UK in October. We'll hear from the distributor in a moment. First, our reporter Nicola Berenger spoke to mothers of children aged between 5 and 8 about whether or not their children have got a mobile.
No, they don't have mobile phones, and I don't see the need for them to have one yet.
When do you feel is the right age for a child to have a phone?
We felt it was right for my eldest child when she started secondary school, because she went on her own on the bus for the first time, went on her own to school and came home on her own. It was quite a scary new world for her. And you know, once she missed the bus and got the wrong bus, and she called and was all distressed, and we had to go and drive to pick her up from somewhere she didn't recognise. And so it was a useful thing at that age.
And what age was that?
11.
I've considered giving my daughter a mobile phone, I'd say about 8, maybe when she does, you know, goes to the gym and things like that, a little bit more active.
But why would an 8-year-old need a phone?
Your child could phone you to say, come and pick me up, Mum. If they're round at a friend's house on a play date, they do more play dates, sleepovers, they could give me a call rather than sort of asking at a house they're at to use the house phone. The children nowadays just don't seem to sort of work that way anymore.
It sounds like it's more for you than for your daughter.
Could be more for me to feel more assured. You know, there's a lot of weird people out there, so you look at the safety.
None of my children have a mobile phone.
Have they ever asked for a mobile?
Yes, the boys ask frequently for a phone. And they say, because all my friends have a phone. They say, I'm the only one who hasn't got a phone, Mummy.
Do you think that's true?
I don't know, and frankly, I don't care.
well, the views of some others in Surrey. So when, as a parent, do you succumb and buy your offspring a phone? The mobile for young children we mentioned is being distributed by Frances Crean, who brought out the Firefly in Ireland 2 years ago. She's with me in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Graham Phillips of Power Watch, the public information group, joins us from Cambridge. Good morning, Graham.
Good morning.
And on the line from Dublin, Áine Lynch, who's the chief executive of the National Parents' Council in Ireland. Áine, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's start with you then, Frances. Why did you decide that your child needed a mobile phone? Because I know that your involvement in this industry was inspired by one particular incident, wasn't it?
Yeah, we actually had a health scare with our daughter back when she was six at the time. She was like a lot of other children attending a summer two-week camp where we dropped her off in the morning, collection in the afternoon. She became unwell, and it was a large camp with a lot of people attending it, and unfortunately just the signs of how ill she was weren't picked up. So when we collected her, she ended up being rushed to hospital with suspected meningitis. And afterwards I decided we wanted to get her something that she could use. And when you say mobile phone, people conjure up images of the phones you and I use, because that's all people know. Mm. And these handsets are very different to that.
Well, I've got one in my hand now. I mean, they are much smaller, they're chunky, they're brightly coloured, and there's only five buttons you can press?
Yes.
Which allow you to do what?
The parent has a PIN number to access the menu, and the parent can program anything from one number to 22 numbers into the handset. And the beauty about the security in the handset is they can lock out everybody outside that user group. So for example, my daughter's five numbers in hers. I know who can contact her and I know who she can contact.
And no texting?
There's no texting and no downloading, and it has an 8-day battery life, so it needs to be charged once a week.
Graham, have you got any concerns then about this? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think my biggest concern at the moment is that the scientific evidence that's being published at the moment is suggesting probably more of a probable now than a possible risk of long-term phone use leading to brain tumours. If there is a risk, it's likely to be a bigger risk in children, purely because they're developing, they've got thinner skulls.
Yeah, the truth is we don't actually know, do we?
No, we don't know. And I think in the meantime, the government certainly consider it to be concerning enough to have issued official advice saying that children and young people under 16 really shouldn't use a phone except in absolute emergencies.
Let me just
advise to heed.
Yeah, emphasise that on the cancer research website, they say there is currently no firm evidence that using a mobile phone will increase your risk of developing a brain tumour or any other type of cancer. That seems pretty clear to me. But Graham, you say that better safe than sorry, and we don't know about the long-term effects.
Absolutely. I mean, if by no firm evidence you mean there is no guaranteed proof that that's the case, then I would agree. That's true. I think the evidence is more probable at the moment than firm. But that, for me as a parent, is enough to think, well, actually, considering brain tumours are typically fatal, I would rather be on the safe side than sorry. My children at that age are unlikely to be in a position where they'd need to use a phone anyway, because they're either in my care or the care of another adult that I consider responsible enough to contact me in case of a problem.
Áine, these phones have been available in Ireland for the last couple of years. Are you still concerned about them?
Yeah, we would have concerns at very young children having mobile phones. And I think one of our main concerns is that the message that gives the child as to who is responsible for their safety, and gives them in some way a sense that they might be responsible for their own safety.
Yeah, I mean, at what point do you think a child is old enough, sensible enough to say or to know that they're not well and that they need to contact a parent? That is quite a big responsibility for a small child, isn't it, Áine?
Well, it is, and I think it also gives a child, you know, a sort of subtle message about the adults that you're leaving them with. So if you're leaving a young child with an adult and saying, if there's anything wrong, call me, rather than tell that adult, you may be inadvertently taking away a very important support from that child.
Frances, go on.
I think people are using the context in which I had a need to give my child a phone as me saying to parents that this is the reason you get these handsets. And Áine knows we've been on the market for the last 2 years in Ireland. We market and advertise our product strictly to parents and parents only. And all we do is offer parents a choice. The latest statistics in the UK is in excess of 1.5 million children between the ages of 5 and 10 own a phone that you and I use, that has full texting, full download, internet access, And parents need and want choice in the marketplace. And all I bring to the market as a mum myself of three, my fourth on the way, is choice. We never, ever stipulate an age. And parents themselves who go onto our website and have a look at how we do it will realise that we do it responsibly. We market it responsibly.
I suspect, though, Frances, that actually once a child gets to, say, 10, they won't want this sort of phone precisely because it's aimed at young children. They're going to want the real thing, aren't they?
I don't actually agree. I think parents are the people now that have the power to make the choice. And mobile phones, is, as Graham has said, and Graham is dead right, have the exact same concerns as he does. I do not want my children to have access to a handset whereby they can be on the phone constantly, playing games, texting constantly. I want a phone, and my child understands this is a piece of equipment she uses to contact me.
Yeah, except that I can imagine a playground situation in which a child is teased for having this, a baby phone. That's what they're going to call it, because they can't play games and can't text.
I think a lot of children, and certainly one thing I teach my children, and parents teach their children, that to stand up for themselves and to not suddenly give in to peer pressure. So what, we all give them the latest technology because the other kids in the school, when it's been shown on a daily basis, whether health risks, text bullying, happy slapping, there are huge negative sides to mobile phones, but yet parents have a need to stay in touch with their children.
Mm. Graham, what about the cost of it? I mean, who should pay for a mobile?
The cost as in financial
the bills,
cost.
Paying the bills.
Well, I think, I mean, coming back to what was said about where it's being marketed, I think it makes little difference whether it's marketed at the parents or the child. It's quite clear that because of the style and design of the phone, as you said, it's going to be used by quite young children, because older children wouldn't want to be seen with something which looks, for all intents and purposes, like a very child, young child friendly, so to speak, phone.
Yeah,
so the parents are obviously going to be paying the bills on it.
Yeah, but I mean, is that giving children the right message, Frances? I mean, it's basically saying you can do what you like and we'll pay for the consequences. I mean, are we really saying that's the right thing to say to our children?
But I don't believe that's what parents do. Parents take this very, very seriously, and I take it as a parent very seriously. My daughter attends after school camps, goes to friends' houses, and I don't in any way, I teach her to trust the people she's with, and I trust the people's care she's in. And she understands that she has this handset, whether she needs to use it once a month or once every 2 months. I am so glad she carries something, and it'll be a long time before she has a traditional mobile phone, because I don't want her to have access to a traditional handset. A phone is needed to contact somebody in case of an emergency when it comes to a young child, and most parents agree that's
but
what we use it for.
Yes, we accept that now for some reason, but I mean, I grew up, and I'm sure you grew up, at a time when we couldn't contact our parents 24 hours a day, and we got through, we did cope. It is possible, isn't it? Or is it simply that because everybody else has got one, we all have to have one?
No, I think society is changing. Parents are now working, more parents are both working full-time, and society is changing. You can't have media stories about this danger and that danger and stranger danger with children and then expect in the same breath to say we should give our children back their innocence. It's about teaching children a little bit of independence and doing it in a way. I don't want to give my daughter a handset and then constantly be checking who she's ringing, who's texting her and who she's texting. I want to give her a phone where I have set the parameters in that handset that I know I have, do not have to have any queries about who she's contacting and who's contacting her.
Anya, what about our obsession with keeping in touch constantly?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important question, because I think, you know, when phones like this are being marketed at parents as being something to help keep their children safe, it can put parents under a huge dilemma as should they take this up? Would it be a responsible thing for them to do? But I think what we'd be advising parents to do is to look at what the risk is that you're trying to keep your child safe from. So in this instance, it could be that your child is sick and not at home, or that they need you in some way. Look at that risk and see what you can do to keep them safe. So one option is to make sure that wherever you're leaving your young child, either whether they're with you or with some minder, that you make sure that you're very clear with the minder about the rules, if they're sick, if they're distressed, if they're upset, what that minder will do, and that you're happy with that, and that you're happy with the level of care that that you're leaving the child with. The other option is to buy the child a mobile phone. Now, what we'd be saying is that our preferred option would be for parents to make all the necessary arrangements before regarding who their children are being left with. And that
right. Well, I don't think Frances is saying that a mobile phone is a decent substitute for high-quality childcare.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay, Frances, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Anya Lynch as well, Chief Executive of the National Parents Council. And you also heard from Graham Phillips of Powerwatch. Now, still to come on Woman's Hour this morning, the myth of Baba Yaga and what it tells us about attitudes to older women. And we also have the next part of our serial set in a 16th century Italian convent. That's Sarah Dunant's Sacred Hearts, of course. Now, in the UK, about one in 34 babies born is a twin or a triplet. In 1980, it was just one in 52. But a new survey suggests that two-thirds of parents expecting a multiple birth don't get access to what's called multiple-specific parent education, meaning they aren't properly prepared for what lies ahead, not just the inevitable sleepless nights, but the possibility that their babies may be born prematurely and have other health complications. Now, the Twins and Multiple Births Association, TAMBA, has launched its TAMBA Healthy Multiple Pregnancy Guide. Lorna Wood is a specialist midwife at the Women's Hospital in Liverpool, and that hospital has its own multiple birth clinic. Good morning to you, Lorna.
Good morning.
Maggie Brighton is a clinical psychologist and an honorary consultant to TAMBA, and she's also the mother of six-year-old triplets. She's in Dundee. Maggie, hello. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hi.
Take us through your pregnancy then. When did you find out you were having triplets?
Well, it was at my 13-week scan, so it was a bit of a surprise because it was a natural conception. Found out there and then that we were expecting three babies rather than our expected one. And from there, we were, I guess, on a bit of a roller coaster ride through and until we had the babies.
What kind of specialist help then did you get during a pregnancy?
Well, certainly your care changes at that point because you're referred from primary care, from care from the midwives, up to the hospital where you see a consultant who is a specialist in I guess what's termed as high risk pregnancies. So from there on, rather than having kind of personal care, you're more highly monitored by a consultant. So in the hospital, yeah.
So what was wrong then with the treatment that you got?
I don't think there was anything necessarily wrong. There were just elements that were missing. I would say because it was a consultant-led twin clinic, which I attended, the consultant was fantastic and really helpful, but you see them maybe for 10 minutes within that time and you're scanned and monitored and basically your pregnancy is monitored for any problems which may arise rather than... and you're so pleased when you get to the end of the next scan and you realise that there's no abnormalities and that everything's going fine. But you don't really get a chance to have that shared experience that perhaps singleton mums get and their antenatal group, where they're going through the experience with other mothers who are at the same stage. And that way, that's an emotional support which I was lacking. And you tend to feel perhaps... or I did, my experience was that I felt more isolated and I had to really research into the topic and what my care was, how I wanted my care to be.
But you must have been prepared for the very real possibility that the babies would be very small, might have to be in incubators for quite some time, that perhaps you wouldn't be able to touch them. That they'd be premature. You knew all about that.
Sure, yes. And obviously that's discussed with your consultant. I visited the neonatal unit that was a great experience to do that, to actually see babies that size. But some mums don't get that opportunity because neonatal units are obviously very careful now about the spread of infection and you don't get that opportunity to go and visit or even see what it's going to be like. So it is still quite a shock for a lot of mums. I was very lucky at that stage that the unit let me go and have a look around.
Lorna, I just wonder how you can really prepare anyone for the prospect of looking after newborn triplets. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's difficult to prepare mothers, but I think a key aspect of that is offering antenatal classes specific for multiple pregnancy. And I think... support from other mothers, I think not feeling isolated and knowing that you're not the only person going through this multiple pregnancy is absolutely key. And another thing, I think it's very sad that Maggie didn't have a specific midwife to look after her as well as part of that team, which we do have in Liverpool and other areas of the country. And I think just having a named midwife with perhaps a bit more expertise in multiple pregnancy does reduce anxiety and does help in the preparation of the impending birth of the babies.
Yeah, Maggie, I know you did go on to develop postnatal depression, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes.
Do you think that might have happened even if you'd had more specialist help?
I don't know. There's so many contributing factors to postnatal depression. So I think it may have had a protective factor if I had had perhaps other people around who were in a similar situation. And I certainly knew triplet mums, but they were further down the road than me. You know, they'd certainly had 2 or 3 year old children. So it's a different experience than kind of going through at the same time as other parents. So having that peer support, I think, would have helped.
Yeah, I mean, just tell us, actually, because I've no idea, what was it like in the first couple of months with 3 newborns? How much sleep might you have got on an average night, if there was such a thing?
On average, when it was up, they were being fed, say, at 3 hourly. So within that 3 hours, it usually took about 2 hours, really, to get everybody fed and happily settled. So by the time you'd got everything tidied up and went back to bed, I guess you would have about, sometimes, if you were lucky, an hour, 45 minutes sleep between the next time that you were up. It depended how quickly and how well settled the babies were.
Oh, God. I mean, and this went on for how long? How many months did you take that as the norm?
Well, I would say initially it varies from everybody, but for us, because we had other factors going on, and my babies seemed to like to be one awake at a time rather than all sleeping at the same time. Although I did get them into a good routine, and they are great children, but they seem to be able to sense when you were on your own, so yeah, they could sort of wake up and say, right, I'm going to have some mum time now. So they're very good at that. However, I think maybe that went on for at least the first year, for my experience.
Yeah, I mean, Lorna, we know that mm-hmm. more twins and triplets are being born, so surely it has to be a priority to get parents during the course of the pregnancy to have very specialised help. Is that happening? Certainly seems to be happening in Liverpool.
It does happen in Liverpool, and I think it probably happens in most big sort of regional units, but unfortunately it doesn't happen throughout the country. And I think it should be happening, you know, despite how many multiple pregnancies you actually look after within your unit. Mm-hmm. There should be a named midwife, and I think that's, you know, up to midwifery colleges and things to sort of pursue that and ask the heads of midwifery to perhaps find a midwife who's specifically interested in multiple pregnancies to take on that role, because sometimes just that contact is enough.
Yeah, I mean, I don't
and
know.
A midwife can then, you know, you can contact other women in the same situation, even though you haven't got a big enough group to have a specific class.
Do you
one-to-one
ever?
One preparation is absolutely vital.
Are you ever shocked, Lorna, by the ignorance of people who are expecting twins about how little they know about what lies ahead?
Not really, because I don't. You wouldn't expect anyone to have any.
You don't really know when you're having one child.
You don't know if it's a first baby. It's a first baby or babies, and you're not going to have that experience. And that's why I think it's key to have classes, really. And I think the survey from Tamba is excellent. It's depressing but excellent, because the information is there, and we should act on that from a midwifery point of view.
You say the information is depressing.
The guidelines,
what is depressing about it?
Well, just the fact that there was only 1/3 of women were offered specific parent education classes. I think that's absolutely dreadful in this day and age. From a midwifery perspective, we should be offering all women that expertise and that information and that opportunity of having peer support from other women, because mm-hmm. some women in classes meet friends and they have long-term friendships, and, you know, throughout their children's lives, and that is absolutely key to reducing isolation and anxiety and, you know, ultimately postnatal depression.
Lorna, thank you very much. Maggie Brighton, thank you to you. Obviously, I'm completely ignorant of this. If you have got twins or triplets, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what kind of information and support might have helped you during pregnancy. Email the programme via the website bbc.co.uk/radio4/womanshour. Now, the myth of Baba Yaga may not be familiar to you, but it's one of the most famous stories in Russian and Eastern European mythology. Baba Yaga is a real grotesque, a snarling, venomous witch who lives in a house balanced on chicken feet. And her business, you won't be surprised to hear, is ensnaring young children. Where's Freud when you need him? Now, in her latest novel, Baba Yaga Laid an Egg, the Croatian writer Dubravka Jugrasic, who left her homeland for Amsterdam, uses the myth of Baba Yaga to explore our attitudes to old age. The themes range from a woman's rather difficult relationship with her mother to the tale of 3 aging women, all potential Baba Yagas, on holiday at a fancy spa. The stories are brought together by the novel's 3rd section, a letter to the book's editor from a scholar providing a Baba Yaga for beginners. I spoke to Dubravka and I asked her about the character of Baba Yaga.
She's nasty, capricious, ugly. She has a huge nose. She has long, long breasts, sometimes huge breasts. but usually very long, and she hangs those breasts. There is a, in Russian huts, Russian wooden huts, there is a special place where people used to hang like clothes or something else. So she hangs them there. And she's mobile because she flies in mortar, helping herself with a pestle and with a broom. With broom, she covers her traces, and with the pestle, this mortar is a combination between a flying machine and a boat.
So we've got here a hideously ugly woman with gigantic, pendulous bosoms. She's mobile. Doesn't she eat children as well?
It is said in some fairy tales she threatens everybody that she will eat her or him. But I think that she usually likes the boys' meat, but okay, she never eats girls. And she threatens everybody. I will eat you, she says.
And sometimes she just has one daughter. Other times she's got 40 daughters.
She's so ambivalent that she's known as a mother of one child, Marinushka, but she can have two daughters too, sometimes 42 daughters. Sometimes she's a mother of dragons, and sometimes she gives birth to frogs, insects, reptiles, and all disgusting creatures.
So what do we hear about Baba Yaga? What do we learn about the cultures that celebrate her and talk about her?
What do we learn? We learn, in fact, that female characters could be very rich, very interesting, could have many functions, and we really don't know the beginnings. Some researchers say that Baba Yaga was goddess in her pre-Christian time, so she was well known as a golden Baba, and probably being a great goddess, she was a goddess of fertility. Then, thanks to missionaries, soldiers, travelers, they spread the story about Baba Yaga, and she penetrated into an oral culture, into fairy tales. But let us say that Baba Yaga is a character which is known in absolutely every folk traditional culture as an old hag, an old witch.
Your book is not entirely about, but certainly heavily features, old age and a fear of old age, doesn't it? Where does all that come from?
First of all, it comes from life, and it comes from our culture. Our culture denies death and aging. We are all obsessed with staying younger as much as possible.
You've got a copy of the book with you, haven't you? Can you just read to us an extract from the second page, I think it is, which I think is a really good illustration of
this. Yes. They shuffle around the world like armies of elderly angels. One of them peers into your face. She glares at you, her eyes wide, her gaze a faded blue, and voices her request with a proud and condescending tone. She's asking for your help. She needs to cross the street, but she cannot do it alone, or needs to clamber up into a tram, but her knees have buckled, or needs to find the street and the house number, but she has forgotten her spectacles. You feel a pang of sympathy for the old lady. You are moved. You do a good deed, swept by the thrill of gallantry. It is precisely at this moment that you should dig in your heels, resist the siren call, make an effort to lower the temperature of your heart. Remember, their tears do not mean the same thing as yours do. Because if you relent, give in, exchange a few more words, you will be in their thrall. You will slide into a world that you had no intention of entering, because your time has not yet come, your hour, for God's sake, has not come.
Yes, I mean, that's a very stark illustration of, I think, probably how many of us feel when we see the old ladies struggling with their shopping going down the street. And you know that if you're lucky, you'll be one of them.
I think that that women, more than men, I would say, have that confrontation with the aging if their mothers are old enough and if they are patient and passionate enough about their mothers to take care of them.
What do you mean? If you see your mother aging,
yes,
you.
This is you. Basically, you see yourself.
Yourself, yeah. You actually, it's interesting because I'm much less patient with my mother than I might be with another lady of the same age.
Yeah, because you are angry. You don't want to see what you're seeing. You don't want that confrontation. You think somewhere, no, I'm going to skip that. I'm going to be better.
What about your own mother? Because you certainly grew up in Croatia.
Yeah.
Your mother, though, is Bulgarian.
Yes.
And there's a lot about her. Well, there's a character in the book,
yes.
Who is a fastidious housekeeper.
Yeah.
And was that your mother? Was that what she was like?
Yeah, she was like that. But also, what is interesting, when I did the research about old hags and old witches and characters from all over, then you see that, in fact, being a perfect housewife is one of characteristic of Baba Yaga. And that was the way how to test young girls. So you have it in mythology too, not only in real life, like in my mother's case.
What about growing up with that sort of split heritage? Heaven knows that the former Yugoslavia is complicated enough, and now you have your Bulgarian side thrown into the mix as well. How does that manifest itself?
I think it's fine. The more, the better.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you have, I know, to say the least, an antipathy towards nationalism, don't you?
I do.
That's caused you problems in Croatia, hasn't it?
Yeah. It did. It started in 1992 when I simply appalled by my surroundings, that hysterical nationalism, really, started to write about that. So I was spotted by the local critics and journalists. I published my first article abroad in Die Zeit, in German newspaper. And then I became a target of media, politicians, my fellow writers, and so on and so on. So I was proclaimed the public enemy, up to being a witch, by the way. So,
are you rehabilitated then in Croatian eyes, or are they still slightly suspicious of you?
You know what? Small cultures and small countries and small people, they never forgive and they never forget. So in that respect, yes, I'm going there. My books are published there, but they wouldn't say that I'm reintegrated into Croatian literary scene. Neither I wish to be. So
that suits you.
So it's mutual.
Does that upset your mother at all? The fact that, because you really did, you were treated really very harshly by the Croatian authorities, weren't you?
She was very funny about. I mean, there are funny episodes about that because, you know, at one point she started to brag, like, "Stop writing against. You should behave yourself. And besides, think about me. They're going to take my retirement."
Lose her pension. That's what she
was pension, yes, my pension. And I said, "Don't worry, nobody's going to take your pension."
Only a mother could say that, really, couldn't she?
Only a mother could say that, yes.
But she said it with love.
Later she was proud. She was proud of it.
Mm. You left,
so she supported me, yes.
You had to leave Croatia.
No, I didn't have to leave Croatia. I could adapt, I could stay, I could say a few supporting words for the local nationalists, but I didn't and I couldn't, so that's why I left.
Could you live there now, do you think? Would you want to live there now?
I don't know. I don't think that one should make, you know, firm decisions, because life is bigger than us, so you never know.
Dubrovka Ugrasic, and the novel is Baba Yaga Laid an Egg. It's out now. And now we return to our serial Sacred Hearts, a dramatisation of Sarah Dinant's book, set in an Italian Renaissance convent. This is part 6, Miracle. It's the carnival, and the novice Serafina has disappeared.
March the 5th, 1570. The convent of Santa Caterina, Ferrara. It is 2 months since the novice Serafina was put here against her will. And now, while the sisters present our carnival play, I realize the girl is nowhere to be seen.
Serafina?
I have not been in her cell since that first night. I see her briefly as she was then, hair wild, howling for her freedom.
I'm buried alive in this tomb!
She lies very still and thin beneath her blanket. Where did it go? All that rebellion? Did it just evaporate?
Are you unwell?
I pull back the blanket and find a bundle of cloth. Sweet Jesus, what has the girl done? I'm moving fast now, though it is against the convent rules to run. And even as I come into the garden, I am remembering a broken line of stone seen from the tower and words, questions, about the storehouse by the river.
Locked?
Only the abbess and the chief converser have the keys.
Has the girl taken in and used everything? By the time I reach the storehouse, I am breathless. I press my ear to the locked door. Beyond it, there will be another door, and beyond that, double doors to the river. Is there someone in there? Do I imagine that? Locked, of course. How could she possibly have got the keys? The chief converser sleeps with them under her mattress.
I dosed her with Basil and Eau de Vie. They gave me dispensation to help.
The truth grips me like cold iron.
Ah, Suora Zuana. Lady Paola, may I introduce our beloved dispensary mistress?
I ask forgiveness for the interruption, Madonna Chiara, but I need the keys to the river storehouse.
Are we in need of supplies?
It is for one of the younger novices.
I see. Do you need help?
No, I'm fine alone.
Here. Come back, won't you, as soon as you've found what you're looking for.
The key slips into the lock and turns as I steer the door open.
Serafina?
The silence is enormous. It is as if 1,000 needle pricks are running through my body. In the darkness, everything appears as it should be, except for the fact that the door ahead of me is open. There is no noise, but there is something stronger than sound. The double doors that open onto the river are wide open, showing the dock and the old rowing boat and the water beyond, as well as a figure dressed in the missing costume for the play.
Don't come near me.
Get away from the water's edge.
Serafina, what are you doing?
What does it look like? I'm leaving. He's taking me away.
He? Who? Who is taking you?
He's here. He's coming any moment. I can hear his boat. Just go away.
Serafina,
this is madness.
Don't move. If you move any closer, I swear I'll jump.
Listen to me. It doesn't have to be like this. At the end of the year,
I will never make it to the end of the year. You said so yourself.
But what you are doing can't work. You can't live outside. The scandal...
I don't care about the scandal. Don't you see? I'm not like you. He will look after me.
There's no one out there.
Then I will get in the boat and I will find him. I just need to loosen the rope.
Serafina, you'll drown.
I don't care. Whatever happens out there is better than the slow death in here. I know you found a way to bear it, but I can't do it, Swanna. Please.
God be with you, Serafina.
Thank you.
Get hold of her! Stop her! Now!
No!
Get her off the boat! Quickly!
Get your hands off her!
Put her back into the storm!
No.
Come on!
No.
The keys!
No.
What?
No.
Give me the keys, Swanna! There. It's over. It's all over.
No! Jacopo! No!
Listen to me, girl. You could have waited out there all night and he would not have come. He left Ferrara 2 days ago.
What? No! You don't know anything about him.
On the contrary, I know a great deal. I know that he, Jacopo Bracciolini, you see, I know his name, is a very lucky young man. He has been offered a job in Parma, assistant capella master, no less, and he has gone there.
No, no, he wouldn't. No, he wouldn't. He loves me.
Oh, he may have said that, but what he really loved was your father's money. The truth is that God will care for you much more than any man ever will.
No, he wouldn't. Just
Believe that if you will, but believe this also. For the welfare of your family and this convent, what happened tonight never took place. Is that clear?
No!
I must return to the refectory. You will have to get her back to her cell on your own. Can you do that?
Yes.
Good. We will talk of this later.
Serafina, what are you doing? What have you got there? No, don't drink it!
Too late. All gone.
What was it? Poppy syrup.
It's what they give people before they kill them. Isn't that what you said?
Oh, Heavenly Father, how much did you drink? Oh, my sweet child. Can you help me? Walk with me.
I think it was enough not to feel pain. I hope it was.
Shortly afterwards, the abbess announces there will be no service of matins that night. After such wondrous performances, her flock has earned a rest, she says. And so, as the convent slides into sleep, we meet again, the abbess and I, in a corner cell. There, she holds open a young girl's mouth, and I pour inside it a draught of poison made with white hellebore root. It does not take long for the first spasm to hit.
O God, rebuke me not in thine indignation, neither chasten me in thy watch, for I am...
The bowls fill and refill, and as the diarrhea starts, the stench becomes unbearable. We strip her down to her shift, so she will soil herself as little as possible, and we wrap her hair in a piece of material to keep it from falling over her face. Somewhere towards the end of the night, the abbess leaves.
I will have to appear at Loud's, or there will be talk. But first, I will return the stolen costume to the props cupboard, and then I must wash and dress. Listen to that rain. Carnival is over, and our Lord is washing the streets clean. Tomorrow, it will be Lent.
Don't be frightened, Serafina. Remember how I said that sometimes we must use one poison to cure another? This will not last forever.
What I do not say, what I do not have the words for, is that other things are more permanent. For the truth is, this 16-year-old girl lying in front of me is in love and imprisoned against her will. That is the truth. And what remedy is there for that? Oh, forgive me, Lord, for not seeing what was in front of my eyes, for not seeing her despair. Forgive me, and let this child live.
Suor Zuana, the abbess has given me permission to say prayers.
She is sleeping.
Oh. I had no idea her fit was so serious. She's dying.
No, she will wake soon. I know she will.
Do not despair. You have done all that could be asked of you. There comes a point where you must give it up to God.
I don't want her to die.
Let us pray together.
It was too much. If not the poppy syrup, then the hellebore. I gave her too much. Oh, God help me. I sit at her side long after Suora Umiliana has gone. Later that night, I roll the child on her side, as my father would have done, in case she wakes and vomits, and close her cell door gently behind me. I return to the dispensary for angelica root, so that I can keep going. The room is clean, the floor washed. Life goes on. And the very thought that life does this and leaves people behind brings tears, a rush of tears streaming down my face. I must get back to her. It is only when I cross the cloisters and see the door of her cell wide open that my heart begins to pound. I forget the rules and run.
See, oh yes, you can see him. I know you can. He's come to welcome you back.
So, Magdalena.
See how he pleads for you. If you open your eyes, he will be there.
So, Magdalena.
No, not yet. I'm with the child. See, she is better.
She's sick, very sick. She can't hear.
No. Her eyes open. She's awake. See what he has done for her.
Oh, Serafina. Oh, welcome, welcome.
He has been waiting for you to find him. He has been waiting so long.
I heard voices. Is she dead?
See, I said he would come.
Sweet Lord Jesus, Sora Magdalena has brought her back to us. Help the girl sit up. She's trying to speak.
Oh, I have been in the depth of hell. Roasted, grilled, sliced and diced into bleeding bits. And all around me, oh sweet Lord, women like me everywhere. Flesh and pulp and silent screams. But it is over now. The pain has gone.
If you open your eyes, he will be here.
He? But he is not here. He did not come. With his full lips and his long curling hair and his soft, soft skin, he went to Palmer.
He cares for you. He will not leave you. Open your eyes and let him in. See how his poor feet bleed.
I see light. I feel it. She's right. The face I know has gone, and I see another. And it is like the face above the altar. He is coming closer, bathed in light. Yes, I see that. A beautiful head pierced with little ruby wounds.
He has sent me to wake you, child. Oh, he cares so much.
This he will not leave me. He would climb a cross and hang in an agony of eternity waiting. This he loves me.
Child, can you hear us? Help her to sit.
See, he is here.
Please, don't crowd the girl.
I said he would come.
She opens her mouth. She speaks.
I saw him. Yes. I do think I saw him.
And the next part of Sacred Hearts on Woman's Hour tomorrow. Thank you for all your emails about mobile phones. I think Angela's example here is the most extreme one. She says, my 15-year-old daughter just ran up a bill of £223 in a week using her dad's mobile. £110 of that was used on 1,296 texts to her best friend. As a consequence, I wonder whether there's any right age for a youngster to be entrusted with a phone. Do join us tomorrow on Woman's Hour. Our special guest is Florence from Florence and the Machine.
And Woman's Hour was presented by Jane Garvey and produced by Lucinda Montefiore. The editor is Jill Burridge. After the news, Joshua Rosenberg joins scientists as they probe the brains of young criminals and ask whether offenders with physically damaged brains can be held legally responsible for their behaviour. That's The Criminal Mind in a couple of minutes.
Islamic art was one of Morris's constant sources of inspiration.
BBC Radio 4 hears how the Muslim world influenced the Victorian designer William Morris.
In this room now, I can see there's a number of different tile patterns. I mean, looking at those tiles, they just look as if they've come straight out of a mosque, actually.
And how his work inspires today's British Muslim artists.
We are trying to find some journey, and in one sense, Morris is trying to tell us things. He'll open your eyes to so many things.
Morris and the Muslims, tomorrow morning at 11:30.